Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, your host. I'm here in Edmond, Oklahoma, where we have the Kingdom of David and Solomon Discovered archaeological exhibit. And just this weekend, we've got a very special event to announce the arrival of the Tel Dan Stela, or the House of David inscription here in the United States. This Sunday, September 22nd at 1 p.m., we'll have an event here in the auditorium where Dinesh D'Souza will be speaking, a political commentator and a lover of archaeology and the history of the Bible and of Israel, as well as Armstrong Institute founder Gerald Flurry. The discovery is right here, or the artifact is right here behind me. It's on loan from the Israel Museum in Jerusalem with association with the Israel Antiquities Authority, and we're absolutely delighted to have this here for the next 2 months, coming out of Israel and here having King David come to the United States of America. So in lieu of the discovery that's going to be here for the next 2 months, and what's going to happen on Sunday, this I should say is a free event that you can get tickets to if you're somewhere in the middle of the United States and you want to come. Simply go to armstrongauditorium.org and you'll find a place on the front page there to reserve your tickets. Or if you can't come, you can definitely live stream the ceremony, and that will be taking place at armstronginstitute.org. So to announce the discovery, or to announce the showcase of this amazing archaeological discovery here, I just did an interview with Professor Michael Langlois. He is working at the University, or teaching at the University of Strasbourg. He also works at the Sorbonne in Paris. And he is one of the chief epigraphers that is continuing research and coming up with new research, even new discoveries about this Tel Dan Stela, or House of David inscription. So he's going to discuss some of that in our interview I recorded a couple of days ago before the arrival of the Tel Dan Stela here in Oklahoma. So thank you very much to him. Please enjoy the interview with Professor Michael Langlois talking about the House of David inscription.
Professor Michael Langlois, thanks very much for joining us on Let the Stone Speak again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So you are currently doing research on the Tel Dan Stela, this amazing inscription dating back almost 3,000 years. It's also known as the House of David inscription. This inscription, this stela, is coming to the exhibit here in Oklahoma. It'll be here on September 22nd is when we have our opening event, and people can live stream that if they desire. Information about that is on our website, armstronginstitute.org. So in light of that, I wanted to get your take, your opinion on the inscription, what current research you're doing on the inscription right now. So if you could, please do speak to the Tel Dan inscription.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're very lucky to have it, because this is, inscription is one of the most important archaeological discoveries when it comes to the history of Israel and the Bible. It was discovered a bit more than 30 years ago in 93, if I remember correctly, during excavations north of Israel in Galilee, on a site called Tel Dan, you know, and Dan is one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so there was a city called Dan, and excavations have been going on for decades there. But it was very unexpected to find such a beautiful stele with a nice Aramaic inscription. And of course, the mention, you said it's called the House of David inscription, because yes, it's mostly known for the mention of this expression, House of David. So yes, the stele is very important. There's still a lot of research going on there. As you mentioned, I'm currently studying the inscription itself. But I would say that even after 30 years, there's still a lot to be done on that stele. There's a little bit of a mystery behind it. And the first thing that is striking when you look at it is how beautifully preserved it is. And I think for the people who are going to come and see it, the inscription almost looks as new, you know. And actually, at the time, some people even doubted that it was authentic, you know. And but fortunately, it was from during, you know, controlled excavations, you know, regular excavations, official excavations. It's an issue that has been going on, especially in biblical archaeology, since the 19th century. Most of what's found comes, you know, from illegal excavations or from the antiquities market. And already in the 19th century, there were discussions. Every time something was found, you know, that would relate to the Bible, people would doubt the authenticity. It was the case for the Mesha inscription that we discussed together. It was the case with even with the Dead Sea Scrolls when they were found. And it's always like that. And now, for once, we have something that is found during, you know, official controlled excavations, and still people are still, you know, trying to get rid of the evidence and say, oh, but maybe it's fake, maybe it was planted there. Now, the reason why the stele is in such good condition is that actually the pieces were found embedded in the wall or in the street, which means that it didn't stay for a long time. If you look at steles or inscriptions or artifacts that are, you know, that have been standing there for, you know, centuries or millennia, of course there's erosion, there's degradation, and very often, especially when you try and read the text, it's difficult to decipher. But with the Teldan stele, the inscription was apparently broken very soon after it was made, you know.
Can you speak briefly about when we believe it was made, and then perhaps when it was broken as well?
Yeah, so there is stratigraphy. So that's a good thing when you find artifacts, you know, during regular excavations, that you have a nice, you know, you have the different stratigraphies, the layers of occupation, successive occupation phases of a site. And so when you have layers like this, you can tell exactly, you know, when or relatively precisely when an artifact was made or destroyed. In the case of the stele, it was found, you know, it was probably made and destroyed somewhere around 800 BCE, right? So it's 2,800 years ago, if you will. And so the stele was made at that time, and the script actually matches, you know, the script that we know from other inscriptions from the same time period, Aramaic inscriptions, and so
you're saying you're saying the type of writing, the writing style, that changes over time, and the writing matches that same stratigraphy.
Yes, exactly. You know, we know that the way that people write, you know, is not the same depending on the centuries. There are periods of time when, you know, the handwriting is quite stable, maybe for a couple of centuries, and then it moves very quickly. But overall, you know, when you look at a script, at the way that people write, whether it's a Hebrew script or the Aramaic script, you can usually pinpoint, you know, a period of time, you know, like a century or a couple of centuries. And in that case, you know, the Aramaic script that's being used is very similar to the Aramaic script that we see on other inscriptions from the same time period, from the reigns of Hazael, who was a king in Damascus. He's mentioned in the Hebrew Bible, or his son. You know, we have some other inscriptions from Zakur, from Sphira, from, you know, we have a few other Aramaic inscriptions, and the way the shape of the letters is similar. So it's when you look at the script itself, you know, even without the stratigraphy on the side, you could tell, you know, it's probably, you know, 9th or 8th centuries BCE, right? That would be the time frame, and it also happens to match the stratigraphy of the site, which means that the stele was not only made at that time, but it was also destroyed at that time. So the archaeologists concluded that probably the stele was smashed, you know, destroyed on purpose and scattered, and the pieces were, you know, embedded or, you know, in walls on the street, or which also explains why it looks as new, because probably it stood only for a few decades, maybe, you know, maybe half a century or even less, or I don't know, maybe a century, but that at the most, and then it was destroyed. And now it also relates to the fact that it's written in Aramaic and not in Hebrew. And, you know, Dan was part of the Kingdom of Israel at the time. Now it's the northern border, so you could imagine that you know border cities could switch, go from one kingdom to another.
Mm-hmm.
Like for instance, right now I'm in Strasbourg now as we speak, and which is at the border between France and Germany, because I'm teaching at the university there. And actually, there have been periods of time when Strasbourg was in Germany, and then it was in France, and then back to Germany. You know, this happens, with cities that are at the border between two kingdoms or two states. If there's a war, and then of course, if you conquer a city, you want to erect a steel or a victory inscription to say, I now this is my kingdom, this is my place. And so if it's written in Aramaic, it's fragmentary, but then we would assume that it was erected by maybe an Aramaic an Aramean king, and so maybe Hazael or someone like this, who maybe conquered the place and said, that now this is mine, and so this is a victory inscription. And then maybe later on the city was taken back by the Israelites, and then they decided to smash that stone, that steel, and gather the pieces. So that's a good hypothesis to explain why the steel is in very good condition. The script is very easy to read.
Yeah, I think we have a replica here right now. This will obviously be replaced next week. I think it's actually in transit right now. And so it'll be here on Monday, and we have a few days to set it up in its location. And even the replica and the real one that was in the Israel Museum is just, as you said, very easy to read. It's almost like you can conduct lessons in reading of ancient inscriptions using this as your example, because the ancient letters are very easy to discern. You mentioned the difference between Aramaic and Hebrew. Perhaps you can just speak briefly to the difference and how we know it's different, because I can't read ancient Aramaic, and yet I can read House of David because I know a little bit of Paleo Hebrew. So what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, so of course the two languages are very close. They belong to the same family of languages. We call it the Semitic languages, and then you have Hebrew, Aramaic, Arabic is like Ethiopic. I mean, other languages in the same family. So they are very close languages. You could say like Spanish and Italian. They have a lot of common vocabulary. So of course, a lot of the words are basically the same. And then, of course, the word for house would be bayt in both languages, as well as in Arabic, for instance, and even the word for king, for instance, it's the same word. The pronunciation might be a bit different. We don't know if it was pronounced like now in modern Hebrew, you would say melech, but maybe it was pronounced malk, the consonants are the same. And so, of course, for someone who knew Hebrew, for a Hebrew speaker at the time, they would be able to read a number of words on the steel. And actually, so the languages are not that different. And since the steel is fragmentary, actually one of the fragments, because so they first discovered one fragment, and then the following summer during excavations, they found two additional fragments. And someone at the time said, look, there's on the second fragment that we call B1, there's the Hamelech Hadad in Hebrew, means the king, King Hadad. And said, but it's in Hebrew and it's not in Aramaic. So he thought that maybe like part of, some of the fragments were in Aramaic, others in Hebrew. So the two languages are so similar that, yes, at some point, if you have a very fragmentary text, sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's Hebrew or Aramaic. Now, if you take the whole of it, then yes, the language is clearly Aramaic. But of course, if some people who have studied Hebrew and look at and need to study a little bit of the alphabet, the Paleo Hebrew alphabet, of course, but you would be able to pick up some of the words. And then, yes, on one line you have King of Israel, Melech Israel, and then the following line you have Beit David, which means House of David. So you have interesting expressions that even Hebrew students, I mean, students of biblical Hebrew would be able to decipher.
So can you just speak to let's talk about the historical context for it as much as you can from the stela in also comparison with the biblical text as well. Does the Bible describe the same event in your opinion, just from a different point of view, or how, what's the context for the inscription?
In the Hebrew Bible, so the time frame, as I said, is around 800 BCE, and so it's the time in the Bible when you have, in the Northern Kingdom, you have a dynasty, the Omrite dynasty, King Omri, and then you have other kings like Ahab, is a famous king in the Hebrew Bible, and Jezebel, you know, so all those characters are famous from the Hebrew Bible. At that time period, and then you have a coup, you know, by Jehu, who takes over, and again, so all this is the time frame. This is what's going on if we read the Hebrew Bible. And the enemies at the time are the Arameans. You know, we have a lot of stories in the Book of Kings where they tell, you know, that they have they are at war with the king of Damascus, and sometimes there's even a coalition between the king of Damascus and Israel, the king of Israel against the kingdom of Judah. So it's a time of war, and it's a time of expansion. And we know also it's about the same time period as the Mesha inscription when we talked about the Mesha. So it's the kingdom of Moab. So it's not this, you know, Aram is north of Israel, and Moab is east of Israel, is on the other side of the Jordan River. But basically, the two inscriptions were are from the exact same time period. You know, within a few years, they were you know, made at the same time, and it's a time when there were wars, you know, between, you know, all those little kingdoms. Those little kingdoms, I say little because at the time you have bigger, larger kingdoms or even empires. Basically, you had Egypt, of course. You know, the kingdom of Egypt was very powerful at the time, maybe not as powerful as it was, you know, in the second millennium BC, but it's still a major political power and empire. And then in what would be modern day Iraq, you have Mesopotamia, and at the time also you have the Assyrians, the Neo-Assyrian Empire. So you have two big empires, basically. And in between the two, you have smaller kingdoms, often city-states. That is, you have a main capital city like Jerusalem, and then around Jerusalem, you know, you have a kingdom. And so you had the kingdom of Damascus, you had the Phoenicians at the time, if you go at the border. And so all of these kingdoms are either at war with each other, or they have a coalition against some of the larger powers. So that's what you read in the Hebrew Bible, and that's what you get also from archaeological evidence. From that time period, it's well documented because the Neo-Assyrian Empire, they have good records, good archives. Mm-hmm. So we know that there have been battles, famous battles in 853 BCE. So we know a little bit about that. We have a good idea of the length of some of the reigns. And in Damascus, one of the most famous kings is Hazael, because he has a very long reign. Like, he reigns for four decades, you know. And it's not often that kings are on the throne for such a long time. And we know that Hazael is also has a lot of battles. He's able to expand his empire, his kingdom. I would say it's maybe not an empire, but he goes all the way to the south, almost to the Red Sea. That is what would be modern day Jordan. Even you know, he takes over some of the you know, there were mines there, copper mines, mm-hmm. in there are excavations there in Fainan. I mean, these are names of archaeological sites.
Yeah, the Araba Valley, Jordan, just south of the Dead Sea.
Yes. So Hazael is able to conquer, to go all the way down there, and then he establishes a number of of trade agreements with Cyprus, with, you know, so. His reign is very interesting, and we have a number of inscriptions by the time of his reign in Aramaic, in different places, you know, in the different countries. So this guy is a very interesting character. So he's a good candidate. That inscription is broken, but he's a good candidate to take over the region, maybe Dan, maybe other cities in that region in northern Galilee, and this would more or less fit the biblical account. Sometimes in the Hebrew, in the biblical text, there are some uncertainties as to about the name of the king of Aram. You know, sometimes it's, you know, the king of Damascus, and then sometimes you have a name And so maybe we may wonder, is it really Hazael? Is it Baradad, who's, you know, someone, another king from the same time period? So there are sometimes difficulties. There are difficulties in the Hebrew Bible also between the king of Israel and Judah, because at some point both of them have the same name.
It
They're
does
called
make it
Yoram, you
make
know.
it difficult to get the story straight.
Yes. And so, and they are, not only do they have the same name, but actually they are the same family, because the father, normally there are two different dynasties, because of course they belong to different dynasties. But actually there is a marriage between the two dynasties. So at some point it's like, is it really two different kings, or is it actually the same kings who somehow took over? You know, so there are some discussions about, you know, how should we understand some of those biblical passages, you know, from the Hebrew Bible. So there is some kind of, there are a few question marks in terms of the study of the what was exactly going on. And so if you try and have a specific chronology, even the dates of the reigns of some of the kings of Israel and Judah, there are some uncertainties there. But the overall, the frame, the time frame is we get the picture. The big picture is okay. We understand it's a troubled time. It's a time of war and of conquest, and that's a good time when we can imagine that, you know, an army and king would be able to conquer some of the territory, and then the Israelites would be able to get it back.
To get it back. So let's talk a little bit about, if we may. You said you've done some preliminary research into the Tel Dan inscription stela. This is a discovery that was made 30 years ago. The publishing of the inscription itself came out very fast. I believe as soon as the next year, it was already published, at least in part in 94 or 95. And yet you are going through this process to get some more imagery done, and you're looking at it again. Are you able to, or perhaps you could speak to some of your lines of research that you're following right now?
Yes, it's quite unexpected, actually, because when I was invited to do research on the Tel Dan inscription, because I was invited in Jerusalem, there was an international conference to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the discovery of the Tel Dan inscription, and so I was invited, and I wanted to. I had never done any research on the Tel Dan inscription, but since I had done some research on the Mesha inscription, and mm-hmm. they are from the same time period, the same thing is going on. You have the same expression there, like Beit David, you know, the house of David, the dynasty of David, and it's very interesting to understand why at the time, especially foreign kings, you know, insist it's important to them that, you know, to tell that the king of Jerusalem is of the dynasty of King David, you know. Mm. So this is something very interesting. So first, I wanted to do research about that. But then I realized when I studied very closely the inscription, every stroke of a letter and everything, I realized there are tiny differences in the handwriting between the bigger fragment on the right-hand part, fragment A, that's the big one, the first one that was discovered, and the two smaller fragments that were discovered a year later that are called B1 and B2, those two fragments, the handwriting is very similar. But if you look closely, there are some letters that have a distinctive features that are different between those two sets of fragments. And for me, it came as a shock, because, you know, the steel is, you know, even they put the fragments together, and they are even, you know, there's epoxy now, you know, it's glued together and it's presented as such. And so I assumed that this was not an issue. You know, I didn't think there was a question whether I thought they joined, you know, and the joint was clear. But then I looked more into it. That's why I used, you know, RTI imaging, that is, you know, a specific kind of imaging that allows you to study very carefully the way that the letters are carved, you know, engraved. And now this week we even did the 3D scanning of the Tel Dan inscription, because it was removed from display because it was being prepared to be shipped, you know, to be sent to the US. So it was no longer on display, so we could actually, you know. So this very week, we did a lot of research on that. We did new RT and everything. And so the thing is that, So what to do with the fact that the two handwritings are very similar, yet different? And so there are different, hypotheses. Some people might even say, well, these are two different inscriptions at all. You know, that fragment A is one inscription, fragment B1, B2 is another inscription. But at the same time, when you look at the fragments and when people come and visit the exhibition, they will see that, the surface is the same, the line spacing is the same, the height of the letters is the same. There are a lot of similarities. I mean, if these were two completely separate inscriptions, you would not expect to have those similarities. So what we did also this week is that we studied the orientation of the magnetic field. Now, this is a new area of research. It's called paleomagnetism. And the idea is that the stone, basalt stone, is lava, and when it becomes solid, it captures in a way the magnetic field of the planet of Earth, And so basically, when you cut the stone in from the quarry, you can tell the orientation of the stone. If it's facing north or south, or So the idea is that if the pieces would have completely different orientations, then we would say, look, it's evidence that these are actually, they belong to different inscriptions.
Right.
But the result that we had this week is that no, the orientation is the same. It's fragments B1, B2, and fragment A. They should be aligned like this. They are facing the same side. So it's not even like at some point we thought, maybe they could be like two different sides of the same stela. You could imagine a stela that's written on four sides.
Right.
And so, but it's not even the case. It's not even the case that these are two different sides or opposite sides. They're really from the same side. So, of course, you could imagine that someone would cut two blocks of stone from the same quarry with the exact same orientation, but still they have to be associated. Like even if they, you could imagine, for instance, if you have a monumental gate in a city, that maybe you would have like an inscription on both sides and then the inscription would face the same direction. So this could be, of course, a possibility. But even in that case, it means that the fragments, the three fragments, they belong to the same project, we might say. I don't know I need to think about how we'll put that in writing, because I'm going to publish a paper, of course, about that. But so they have to be studied together. But the thing is that the way that they have been, that they are being presented, with fragment A having the beginning of the lines and fragment B having the rest of the same lines, this doesn't work. And actually, if you look more closely, you'll see that fragment A, the first lines, are slanted. They are going down, which is not very... The scribe didn't do such a good job. You can see that the first lines are going down, and then the scribe corrects himself, and then the following lines are correct. And you don't have this issue with the fragments B1 and B2. So if the way that the fragments are have been glued together, you have to imagine that the lines go down and then somehow are corrected. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So now the fragments, they have to, if they belong to the same inscription, if they belong to the same column, because some could also imagine they belong to two different columns, they have to be aligned differently. Like fragment B should come maybe on top or below. So we need to do some more research into that. I cannot tell you, because we haven't done the research yet. But that's the idea, right? So that's the big big news, and that's what we are investigating now. And to better understand the relationship between the fragments.
And the fact that you said that the difference is understandable outside of the curvature indicates that it would have been above or below rather than from one of the sides, correct? Because at some point he became lazy, or I don't know, he got tired or something, perhaps a human reason.
So yes, and again, yes, to account for the differences in script, in the handwriting. So either it's the same scribe, but something happened to him. Mm-hmm. Like you said, maybe he started out and it was nice, and at some point he got tired, and like somebody told me, maybe he had an injury with his wrist, which happens also. Another option would be that these would be two different people, but with very similar handwriting. Like, for instance, two people who studied at the same school, because these are professional scribes, right? It's different from, let's say, at the time we also have like everyday inscriptions, especially on pottery shards when people want to put a label. And we have inscriptions from the Iron Age written by scribe, by non-professional scribes, by writers, people who write, but they are not professional scribes. And in that case, the handwriting is not as beautiful as here. So here we, the people who did this are professional scribes. So they attended a school. So it's possible that they attended the same school, in which case, you know, they would have very similar handwriting. It's possible that they were working together, like in a workshop. Like, you know, if you want to say, well, you know, I want to have this nice, you know, new city gate with inscriptions, and you know, so maybe you hire a people from a workshop, and maybe, like, you know, one person did, you know, the upper half of the inscription, and then at some point, you know, someone else took over, and they made sure that the size of the letters and the line spacing was consistent. That, you know, for non-specialists, if you look from afar, it really looks like it's the same handwriting, and it's only if you look closely you realize, oh, there are tiny differences. So for now, it's difficult for us to tell whether it's two different people with very similar handwriting or the same scribe who, for some reason, you know, had trouble, you know, writing part of the inscription. So this is we need to keep doing some research about that.
Nevertheless, I think it's really, it's interesting, isn't it, that you can have this inscription that's been read so much, probably one of the most well-read inscriptions for the past 30 years, and yet you come across it again, fresh pair of eyes, and even employing some new archaeological technologies and presenting new evidence, a new story behind this inscription's the way it was written. So that's just wonderful. I think we're about out of time, but this, thank you so much for taking your time with us, Professor Langlois. I'm looking forward to reading your published materials whenever it comes out. And I'll make sure that we catch up again together as soon as we hear from you again with that publication.
Sure. With pleasure. Thank you again for your invitation. I'm always happy to chat with you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for watching the interview of Professor Langlois. Thank you very much to him for taking his time to update us on the latest from this discovery. If you would like to watch the live stream on Sunday, this event that's going to talk about this inscription, as well as having Dinesh D'Souza speak and Mr. Gerald Flory, the founder of the Armstrong Institute, simply go to armstronginstitute.org. And you'll find a place there on the front page where we'll be streaming the event that starts 1 p.m. Central Time. And then you'll also, if you are able to come to the opening itself, there's still some tickets available for free. You have to reserve your tickets at armstrongauditorium.org to do that. I would also like to say, if you haven't requested our magazine, Let the Stone Speak, this is a magazine on biblical archaeology and history that comes out 6 times per year. It's absolutely free. You can simply write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and put your name and address there, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Or you can go to armstronginstitute.org and simply scroll down. You'll see a place where you can request that magazine. Thanks very much for watching.